Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Come and listen to my story about a man named Jed, a poor mountaineer, barely kept his family fed. And then one day he was shooting at some food, and up through the ground come a bubbling crude. Oil, that is, black gold.
Oh, it is going to be a fun-filled episode. Andrew Horowitz here, the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Episode number 63, and we are talking all about oil. What else is there to talk about? I mean, oil at 140, 142, 150, I mean, where is it going? It is going to be a big problem. That's where it's going, because it is affecting almost every aspect of our economy on just a national basis and a worldwide basis. We have to be really concerned right now because there are so many components and so many parts of the overall manufacturing, distribution, and the underpinnings of our economy that revolve around and rely on petroleum-based products. That being said, you have to really wonder, well, what is going to happen if it maintains this kind of price level for a very long time? Some people are saying that it's a supply-demand issue. Others, more vocal right now, including our amazing guest that is lined up, Professor Michael Greenberger, he is saying that there is a huge amount of speculative manipulation that is going on right now that needs to be constrained, and we have something called the Enron loophole that has caused for many to be very alarmed because it is allowing for commodity speculators, particularly in the oil and natural gas and heating oil areas, to speculate and use very thin margin levels. And essentially what they do is they push and push and push the price up of oil and oil futures to levels where we are today. And he's saying that in his congressional testimony that if you close this loophole, which is allows for the unregulation of the oil markets, amazing. You just got to hear what he has to say, that you would have a 25% drop in the price of oil almost immediately. Well, we're going to talk with him. I'm going to bring on John Dvorak because he's a good friend of mine. He and I have been jawboning about this and just talking about this for a long time. And I've written about this. I want to make sure you do something. I wrote about this. It's actually front page of MSN right now, and it's probably be somewhere in the things rotate, so it'll be somewhere in the archives. But I'll put a link on our site to that, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Go over to the show notes, and if you haven't done it, please, I'm gonna kind of beg you or ask you one more time. Make sure to go to that website. This article that I wrote about the Enron loophole is something you really need to take a look at. It's pretty scary stuff. But I'll tell you this. You know, I looked at it recently. The article that I wrote for MSN got almost 80,000 hits or more, 500 or so comments. It is just unbelievable what's going on in terms of this whole debacle and this whole unregulation and eventually what has caused our oil prices to go up. All right, so much for that. We'll get to that in a second. We'll dial in. But I wanted to get to two other things. I have lined up. We kind of changed the schedule around a little bit. We have John Perkins coming up, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. I also have a great trading psychologist, Brett Steenbarger, from TraderFeed.com, coming up on another podcast episode very shortly. And the one thing I do want to bring up before we get into this, because I have a feeling it's going to be a heated discussion. I've got a lot of emails this week that had asked me to just go slower for a second and explain what the indications of interest is for, you know, what they're all about for the disciplined investor growth strategy. So let's just take a second and talk about that so I really clear about what's going on, because there's been an enormous amount of interest there. So just bear with me for like 3 minutes, just 3 minutes, and I'll tell you what it's all about, and then we'll get right to the discussion. So here's the story. What happened was we were continually asked to really provide a service that hopefully could allow for investors and people that to work with our firm. That's what we do for a living here. You know, that's what we do. We manage money. And so what happened was that I put together an idea. I said, if we can create a hedge fund like experience, but not with a hedge fund, so that you'd have individual accounts that you wouldn't have the excessive fees usually related, the margin, all the things that really are negative about a hedge fund, and greater transparency so that you can actually look at the transactions and know what's happening in your own account. Wouldn't that be great? That would be perfect. And bring down the minimums, because my usual minimum is much higher for new accounts. So what we created was really neat. We created this hedge fund-like and a hedge fund strategy for individuals without being a hedge fund. And it is really, what's really cool about it is that when you utilize this, you have full access to your account. So the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, which is right by the book, you know, you just take the book and open it up and you can see how we look at and find stocks through quantitative and technical and fundamental analysis, quanta technifunda. And we created this openly for people, $50,000 minimum. And simply all you have to do is go to where it says indications of interest. Well, right now, actually, because there was such an explosive request for it, we've actually put the thumbs up for it. If you want to invest and you want to explore the opportunity, this is a very actively traded hedge fund-like. So we go short, we go long, we use some options. If you want to look at this, go to the website, check out the indications of interest. There's an entire audio-visual tour that I put together for you so you can see exactly what it is. It shows the past performance of a similar technique that we've used on the things that we talked about here. And it goes through all the parameters. Only go there if you're, you know, considering doing this, because it does have the requirement that you are, of course, an aggressive investor, at least wanting, you know, superior or growth for the investment. And you have a $50,000 minimum. But I do encourage you, because we are so overwhelmed with the response right now. We are going to limit it probably if we get to a certain point we feel it's not able to be managed. But I will tell you, you have to see how neat this process is that we put together for automating what you can do, what you can see. We have a private client area for this that you're going to get updates right to your mailbox or right into the private area that people won't have otherwise. And the entire process is nice and transparent, so you can actually learn what we're doing as we're doing it. So when you see a transaction at the end of the week, we'll put up a post and talk about what it is that we did. Really cool stuff. I'm really proud of the team putting this together. And because of you, the overwhelming response, simply we are going to do it. So that's kind of neat. The main thing that you need to know about, and here's what people ask me about, is, you know, is this available? What do I do? Yeah, it's available. It's not a hedge fund. It's for anyone who wants to do it with a $50,000 minimum. So without belaboring that and kind of going to this whole discussion, I got probably about 25 emails on this to kind of discuss a little bit more, and hopefully now it's a little bit clearer. Go over to the Disciplined Investor, check it out. It's on the site. Indication of interest, we're going to put a little link that says the actual name, which is the Disciplined Investor Growth Strategy, okay? All right, when we come back, I'm going to kind of dial right in, just going to go for a quick break to kind of get it set up. Dial right in, we're going to call up and talk to Professor Michael Greenberger, again, who is talking about oil manipulation and speculation, and bringing John Dvorak to discuss this whole matter on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And the topic of the day, topic of the month, the year is Earl, Big Earl. Oh boy, it's been a problem. And I have asked a gentleman to join us today to talk about some of the things that are going on in terms of the potential speculation in the commodity markets, particularly related to oil, and something that is, I don't think, as well known as most people should know. It's called the Enron loophole, as well as a few other things. His name is Professor Michael Greenberger, and Professor Greenberger has been stirring up a lot of a tremendous amount of dust in this topic, because it's really amazing. He's been testifying on the Hill for some time. He was a former let him introduce himself. Professor Greenberger, thank you so much for joining us.
Very nice to join you.
So, and also I don't neglect to mention, we have my good friend John Dvorak, who he and I have been jawboning this whole idea of the Enron loophole for a while in oil. So, John, you ready to get in on this whole discussion?
Yeah, it's a good, I'm glad that we could get the professor on, because he's the one who triggered much of the current debate when he did his first testimony, I believe, the one with Soros in front of the, was that the Senate, professor?
Yes, the Senate Commerce Committee.
Right.
So the issue at heart here is what is known as a few things, obviously, but oil prices skyrocketing, you know, with the potential issue of manipulation and speculation. So, Professor, tell us what is this whole Enron loophole and you know, what's really going on?
Well, the entire underpinning of the structure of regulating commodities going all the way back to 1936 is that commodities and the commodity markets are essentially designed for commercial hedgers. That is, the most classic kind of hedger is the farmer. These markets developed around agricultural products. They were used for farmers to lock in prices when they began the farming season, so that when the harvest came, they had some kind of guarantee of what their return would be. And a counterparty to them, a natural counterparty, would be a consumer of farm goods, maybe a baker consuming wheat. And the consumer also wanted to lock in prices to make sure down the road that they wouldn't be paying an exorbitant price. And for that reason, outside of a regulatory format, the futures market started. By the mid-1930s, the farmers realized that speculators could overwhelm these markets and unhinge them from supply-demand principles by using various malpractices in the trading process, and they convinced Congress to pass the Commodity Exchange Act. And the essential tool in that act is that speculators are welcomed into these markets, but they must operate under strict controls so that they don't overwhelm them and make them unusable for the commercial interests. And that continued through December 19, 2000. That was the way these markets ran. They developed into other products. For purposes of our discussion, energy futures or crude oil futures. And crude oil futures, like farm products, were regulated in a way that limited speculative participation. That is to say, speculators were welcome, but they could only be a part of the market, so they didn't unhinge it from supply-demand principles. On December 20th, a 262-page law was signed into effect. It did many things that we now see causing disruption in our economy, but for our present purposes, it allowed energy futures to be traded outside of the regulatory format. The so-called, what we now refer to as the Enron loophole, it was passed at the behest of Enron, allowed energy futures to be traded without any controls on speculators. And by March 2002, it was discovered that Enron had used its trading engine to manipulate up the price of electricity on the West Coast by 300%. Enforcement actions were brought. Enron collapsed. But it became a school for scandal, and it was picked up by investment banks and oil companies. Seeing this unregulated market as a backdoor vehicle to increasing futures prices control spot prices, so therefore, by using these markets, what we now call dark markets, they have the ability to drive up the price of oil. And on Monday of this last week, there was a hearing in front of the House Oversight Subcommittee of the Energy Committee, and there were four reputable economists who uniformly testified that whereas there is a supply-demand problem, and that supply-demand problem drives the price of oil up, that price should be no higher than $80 per barrel. Of course, we're now over 140. We're approaching 142. The predictors are we'll be at 150 very quickly and 200 by the end of the year. And the data came forward that these markets are essentially, whereas they used to be 28% speculators, the rest commercial, they're now 70% speculators, the rest commercial. The fact
if I may interrupt you for a second. So sure. Here's what you know, obviously that's a far cry. I mean, we're talking about a huge differential from 140 down to 80 or something, you know, around those lines. And what's really interesting is that, first of all, aside from, and I thought I did some pretty good research here, but aside from the discussions that I've heard from you, and I got to tell you, it is not the easiest thing to dig out information about really what's going on here. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Of course it's not, because the markets are unregulated, unpoliced, and completely opaque. If you want to find out information about these markets, you can't open the Financial Times or the Wall Street Journal. You got to pay a lot of money to figure out what the prices are. But the big guys can pay that money, and the prices being driven on these dark markets are affecting not only the regulated futures markets, but the spot price.
So the one thing that I found really fascinating, if I may just add, I don't know if I mentioned this to you, John, but so last week there was a few weeks ago, there was this farm bill that was passed that attached the theoretical closure of the Enron loophole. I called up Senator Feinstein's office, who was one of the supporters, even though there was many others. But I asked about, you know, what's the story? Is it finally closed? Because to be honest, I couldn't find good information on it. And they told me, yes, it was closed. A week and a half later, I looked at a few things and I saw an article and I was totally flabbergasted to find, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, but the Enron loophole, which was intended to close down the potential problems with regulatory oversight not being the case with the U.S., and it passed, but it was only applicable to natural gas. And they totally eliminated or didn't even put in the crude oil issue. Is that true?
Well, it's effectively true, and if I can just explain that for a second. As I mentioned earlier, before the Enron loophole was passed, all energy futures had to be traded on a regulated, transparent exchange with speculation controls. The way the Farm Bill, end quote, ended, close quote, the loophole was, now the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, has to prove on a contract-by-contract basis that energy futures contracts should be re-regulated. So they have to go through administrative proceedings to get you back to the regulatory structure. That is not ending the loophole. Ending the loophole would have said what was true on December 19th, without any burden on the CFTC, all energy futures are traded on a transparent regulated exchange. But matters get worse. While the plain language of the Farm Bill would seem to apply to crude oil, after it was passed, it suddenly became clear that because the 30% of our West Texas Intermediate Futures contract, the benchmark crude oil contract, is traded on a so-called London exchange,
mm-hmm.
Even though the terminals are in the United States, the contract is a United States contract, the exchange is headquartered in Atlanta, its trading engines are in Chicago. The federal government treats it as if it were in London. And we suddenly learned that those contracts, the major unregulated West Texas Intermediate contract, is not covered by the so-called end the Enron loophole. So, in effect, it only covered natural gas. It didn't cover crude oil. And now, even the authors of the so-called end the Enron loophole, Senators Feinstein, Levin, et cetera, have now got a bill to close the London loophole. There is a lot of other legislation being considered that would return to the status quo ante on December 19, 2000. All energy futures would be regulated. The burden wouldn't be on the CFTC and the public to prove that they should be regulated, which obviously would lead to lots of litigation. And this London loophole for an Atlanta-owned company with Chicago trading engines, mm-hmm. trading 30% of our critical benchmark, would be closed. That exchange, the Intercontinental Exchange, would have to register as a United States exchange.
And that's the big issue. John, did you note that farm bill that was passed that attached this, that had this this other bill attached to it? It was called the CTFC, Reauthorization Act, right. John, did you know that bill, when it was really passed, you know, they seemingly lost 35 pages and they had to do a revote?
Yeah, you mentioned that. That's fishy.
They sent the bill to the president. 30 pages were missing from it.
Whoops.
And so they passed it originally on May 18th.
How do they do that, though? How does that happen?
Well, what you will discover is that it's unfortunate, but if you still believe that people read the legislation they passed, I've got a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you. It's a very sad fact that this legislation is hundreds of pages long, and Congress tends to pass legislation that's hundreds of pages long. And an interesting question to ask anyone who's involved in the passage is, have you read it and do you fully understand it?
Mm,
we find all too often many times legislation is passed that isn't even on the floor for people to read.
Hmm. John, what's your take on this? I mean, you've been following this very closely. You and I have talked about this, you know, on a number of occasions, you know, and it's almost laughable, this whole situation. But, you know, what is your take, and what do you think is going on here?
Well, what I find distressing is the following, and I think Professor Greenberger must have some thoughts on this. I first heard the testimony when Professor Greenberger and George Soros were up in front of the Senate committee, and pretty much, you know, he outlined not much in ways not much different than he's doing now with these details. And then, of course, I mean, we should reemphasize the professor's past existence as a regulator himself. It's mm-hmm. not like he's just a theoretician working out of a university. Anyway, so I listened to the entire discussion because C-SPAN played it. And I noticed that the next day that I don't know that any journalist or business writer or anybody either heard this talk or wrote about it or picked it up or looked at a review of it or anything else. And and it was as though nothing, as though this never happened and was never discussed. And so two or three days later, I'm listening to a news report where somebody's coming on as some other, you know, armchair expert coming on saying, well, you know, it's because we're using too much oil and we're, you know, the problem is that we need to cut back and we have to go to different sources and we can't be dependent on this and that. And I'm thinking, has anybody been paying attention to what's actually going on in the background? And then furthermore, the other thing that kind of amuses me is that I was there during the 1970s oil crisis when they were essentially cutting us off. And there were gasoline lines that I think people forgot about. And one of the things that it was noteworthy because you had to pay people, they weren't getting deliveries of gasoline. We're not seeing any evidence that there's a shortage. There's no gasoline lines. Everybody's got plenty of gasoline. It's like so obviously something's rigged. And nobody, this, and again, let me just make my last comment, which is the fact that during the energy crisis in California, we were having these crazy blackouts, which we've never experienced in our history. And again, the media and the public both were just kind of, well, that's just the way it is now. You know, if we'd use less energy, and it's almost like there's this drumbeat of green conservation that underlies no matter what happens or what the reality is some phony excuse for what's actually going on. And I find it incredibly distressing.
Well, the other thing is Professor Greenberger and John, I told you I wrote this this piece for MSN. It's actually on the front page of MSN right now. It's, there was a little quietly done bill passed on Thursday evening, I believe it was, that talked about how they enumerated powers, special powers to the CTFC, which is the regulatory body that covers the commodities and certain commodity markets, that allows them to essentially put the kibosh on some of the manipulation and speculation, which is all about or a lot about the excessive use of leveraging. What's interesting is that that's only occurred. They've only been allowed to or given this power, I think, four times in the past. And in the letter that was put out by the CTFC, they show and they talk about the four times or so that it was used in the past. And the interesting line entirely that it says, the interesting line is that they clearly state, the CTFC clearly states that it's only been used and it will only be used for manipulation or to curb manipulation. So that's number one. And Professor Greenberger, again, aside from this piece that I wrote, and because I'm on the hunt for this, okay, I got the Google alerts going, I got all sorts of things trying to find information. It's like nothing's being talked about.
Well, let me say that things aren't good if you believe this is happening in terms of who's talking about it, but I think it has become a major issue of discussion, and there is a major debate going on the Hill right now. You will see and of course, not everybody agrees. My own view is a lot of people who don't agree do not understand the way these markets work. But yesterday, the New York Times had an op-ed piece by Paul Krugman saying it was all supply-demand. Today there's an article to the same effect on the business page of the New York Times. But nevertheless, the debate has started. It's a vigorous debate. As you notice, the Congress, on a vote of 401-19, essentially declared an emergency. The CFTC had the power to do it itself, but refused to do it. That bill declares an emergency and instructs the CFTC to look for excessive speculation in these markets. Now, it may be that the CFTC is taking the position we've never used it for that before, but if this legislation passes, what they've used it for is irrelevant. The legislation directs them to look at this across all markets, regulated, unregulated, so-called foreign markets that are in the United States. And were it to pass, it would be a powerful tool. Let me also say that there'll be a vigorous debate over the next month over whether the Enron loophole should be fully closed, whether this London loophole should be ended. There's a lot of legislation that's been introduced that leads to that effect. So it's not as if no one's paying attention. What I will tell you right now is there's a very strong debate going on, and the answer to all this is exactly what you're saying, that it's all supply-demand. Those of us who believe that something should be done about speculation do not disparage the idea that there is a supply-demand problem.
Mm-hmm.
But many people observing these markets who are highly respected said, yes, it's supply-demand, and it should be $80 a barrel. Where does the next $60 to $65 come from? It comes from mindless buying long in these markets, in non-transparent markets. And my view is, if you get into these markets, there's a very good chance that you will not just find excessive speculation, because the history has shown that where there's no police on the beat, you also have manipulation at play. And my final point is, those who argue supply-demand say, don't look at the markets that we can't see. Just take our word for it. It's supply-demand. My answer is, let's look at what's not transparent. You may be completely right, but don't tell me I can't look based on your armchair view about what's going on.
And John, if it is, in your opinion, if it is supply-demand, right? You know, if it is a supply-demand issue, are we any less, are we any more demanding oil this week than we did last week to see the incredible run-up that we saw on crude prices to a record high again? I mean, that's the whole point, isn't it?
Well, isn't there, are we seeing evidence that people are actually cutting back just a little bit? I'm not buying the supply and demand argument beyond $100 a barrel under any circumstances. The whole thing seems like it's manipulated. It just doesn't smell right. And while, yes, you might be, Professor, you might be seeing action in Congress with a lot of people chatting it up in Washington, but I'm telling you, the public at large, as far as they're concerned, they've been told by the media that it's going to be $200 a barrel for oil. I mean, that's the number that keeps cropping up. And nobody has a clue about this, and I think they're being misled.
Yes, and also the price is going up. Just last weekend, the Saudis said, or the OPEC said, they're opening the spigot. And everybody thought on Monday, oh, the price will go down. Well, the price went up $1.36 on Monday, and now it's up approaching $142. Mm. There's a lot of people out there saying, yes, we're going to increase production. And you're right. People are not using their cars substantially. The AAA, I think, has said when it hits 436, there'll be another substantial interruption of people using their automobiles. We're already at a record low use of automobiles. But the price marches steadily ahead. And Goldman Sachs predicts by the end of the year it'll be 200. Morgan Stanley predicts by July 4th, 150.
Well, can I just interrupt you on those particular two names, okay? Goldman Sachs has a huge bet on oil. We know that in their hedge funds. And going back, I think, almost a year now, one of the things that held Goldman Sachs up so well over this time compared to many of the other companies in their ilk was the fact that they had huge bets on a few things. One was a negative bet, I believe, on the housing slash financial markets. But the second thing was that they also had a huge bet on commodities and oil in particular. And Morgan Stanley, from what everything that I can see in the research that I've done, shows that they have essentially cornered the market in the Northeast natural gas supply. So isn't this commentary by them and the stoking of the fire, really just benefiting them?
There are many people who think that they have bets heading in the direction of their predictions, and it does stoke the fire. And I can tell you, while there's a vigorous debate going on the Hill right now, the International Swaps Dealers Derivatives Association, which is the trade group that's the front for a lot of these people who have long bets in this market, they're flooding the Hill with lobbyists and publicists and PR people. And to the extent people listen to your podcast and believe that there is a problem here, my advice to them is it is not a futile gesture to call your senators and the members, your House member, and let them know that you're watching, you believe something must be done, and that it will be something that you will not be happy about if they stand idly by. Whatever the public debate is, there's a major debate going on in Congress right now, and it's very tough because those who are fighting the speculation don't have the resources of those who want to maintain the status quo.
And the other thing is, in terms of the speculation, first of all, I'm going to put a list of senators and congressmen and women and contacts on the show notes. So if anybody does want to write their fellow congressperson or senator or maybe even George himself, I'll put a list on the show notes for this to make it a little bit easier for you. But I want to go backwards for a second. When somebody says to me and asks me, well, what are you talking about? You know, what is this speculation? What does it mean? And I try to bring it down to the easiest kind of, a real easy to understand sentence. And that is this. And tell me if I'm right about this, okay? Essentially, if I had all the money in the world, no limits on money, I can take a stock, let's say, and keep on buying it. And every time I bought it, the shares that I bought the day before would be worth more. And then I'd buy some more the next day and keep it up and just, perpetually keep moving it up. Now, obviously, that would be pretty neat because what would happen is if I was able to and so strong because I had so much money to do that, I would be making a ton of money on the kind of the trailing positions that I had. The question then becomes, of course, when I do sell, what happens then? And it seems to me that the excessive use of leverage in these markets, particularly in the unregulated markets that we're talking about, is kind of, that's a simple discussion, of course, but that's kind of what's going on. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I do. And the thing is, when you go to buy a stock, you have to put up 50% margin. When you go to buy crude oil futures, you have to put up 7% margin. So the leverage here is phenomenal. You can buy, you don't need to have all the money in the world to do this. You can do it with a lot less than you think you'd need. And yes, the wave is all in one direction. It's buy. Now, I must emphasize that many people say the futures market, you have to wind out of your contract. You have to do a roll. So they say there are as many shorts as there are long. So how can there be excessive speculation? Well, the same thing is true in the stock market, For everybody who buys a stock, somebody's selling it, but if you put a lot of money into it, you drive the price up. The idea that there's a short side to every long and that somehow is controlling the price is absurd, but if you pick up today's New York Times, there's a columnist, Joe Nocero, who's essentially saying that. The other point here is that if there's no insider trading controls in this. You can be predicting the price will go to 200. You can be buying the futures product that takes advantage of those predictions. And what's also happening here, if you control the futures price that controls the physical price, you have the people who are speculating starting to get into these markets and buying the actual physical commodity. And there was reference earlier to heating oil, one of the largest holders of heating oil in New England right now is Morgan Stanley.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a full court press driving the price up with basically unleveraged money, and that's it's a very, very unhealthy situation. The legislation, if the Enron loophole had actually been closed, all of this trading would be bumping up against what are called speculation limits. Speculators can only be a limited participant in these markets, but because so much of it, the Intercontinental Exchange, the over-the-counter market, the Goldman Sachs Index Fund for agricultural and energy products, they're all outside of transparency. They're all heading in one direction. Ultimately, as George Soros says, well, this is a bubble, and the bubble will burst, and those people, and especially the worry is, there's a lot of pension fund money being invested through Goldman and their index funds and others, that there's going to be a downside like the housing crisis. But Soros' belief is we're going to have to go through a terrible recession for that to happen, to dampen the demand, to ultimately burst the bubble. It's a very high price to pay. Essentially, we're standing on the threshold of deciding we're going to fix this problem ourselves without any further suffering by re-regulating these markets, or we're all going to go through a very serious recession. I use the word depression there. It's not completely a Freudian slip because people are worried about that too. When you add the energy crisis to the housing crisis and the credit crunch, this is an economy gone wild. And all of this traces itself back to the December 20th, 2000 law that deregulated a lot of products that had previously been regulated. The Enron loopholes futures, they also deregulated financial swaps. When you look at the subprime housing meltdown, the financial instrument that underpinned the house of cards were credit default swaps, completely unregulated. Congress is beginning to hold hearings on that as well.
It seems to me that and actually this discussion goes right into, I want to talk to John about his theories on what's happening in the next few years in terms of depression. It seems to me that this almost, in a very odd way, is some of these financial companies their last way to kind of get themselves out of this mess they built themselves. So if Morgan Stanley and Goldman are really embroiled in a heavy amount of this speculation and they own a lot of this, they could, in theory, come out smelling, you know, really good if they play their cards right and let this run up because of the, you know, to offset the losses they have on the other side. But again, that's, you know, questionable. But John talks about, you know, his John, this fits right into your theory.
To be honest about it, I don't think it really applies to this debate. But let me just bring something else into this. And Professor Greenberger, I'd like to get his comments on it. Do you remember when Bunker Hunt tried to corner the market on silver? Does this remind you of that in any way? Although this is more, you know, kind of institutionalized than just one guy trying to corner the market on a commodity. And of course, it collapsed. And if it collapses, let's face it, we have less demand, and now we have more supply. But the price is going up, as you point out. This is like a classic situation where you have, if things start to turn around, it'll fall faster than imaginable because things tend to fall at a rate of about twice the speed that they go up. And do you sense something like that as a potential? And if so, are you sensing it at 140, 150, or do you think you actually think these guys could hit the 200? Because if it was me trying to manipulate the market, I would talk a big game about 200, and I'd be selling my positions all the way up to 200 to get out because I have a pretty good way of doing that.
If they start selling on the way up, that will start driving the price down. The truth is, I don't see it like the Hunt corner of the silver market. That was done in a completely regulated, transparent situation before these markets were deregulated, and they had to use extraordinary measures to achieve their result. When you have an unregulated market, as we have today, and you have the extreme leverage, you don't have to corner something. You can strategically pick vulnerabilities. The classic example of this is the Amaranth hedge fund that collapsed in September of 2006. for 2 years that one hedge fund by strategically buying certain natural gas futures contracts was able to drive the price up substantially. Now they got cut, they got called out. They now claim that somebody revealed their positions and therefore began a strategy of undercutting them. But the important thing about that is for 2 years, this one hedge fund, you know, not Morgan Stanley, not Goldman Sachs, was pretty much able to control the price of natural gas. And they did it strategically by picking contracts in certain months, certain kinds of contracts. So the people here who are driving the price up are much more clever than the Hunt brothers were and are able to do it in a way that doesn't call into play the strong-term corner. But nevertheless, they're able to achieve the same results. And it's if the Hunt brothers had had access to markets in the United States that were opaque instead of transparent, they would have never had to, quote, corner the market. They could have done a lot of this through a much more clever and less dramatic devices because they would not have been seen by the federal government.
Hmm.
So why, I mean, simply, this is, you know, the simplest question that can be, it seems to me. If really there's no, I don't see any reason to have the Enron loophole open, right? I mean, why would we want to have anything that we are involved in, any commodity, any security, anything that has anything to do with, you know, to be very selfish, just Americans only, why would we want to have anything unregulated in terms of that whole side of the market? I just don't get it.
Well, there are thousands of arguments being advanced for that. One is if you regulate these markets, the traders will go overseas and trade overseas. Two, they say, well, you'll drive liquidity away and the markets need liquidity. They've got a million different answers for all this. You know, the point about driving people overseas, what they mean by that is they'll trade in their terminals on Wall Street, but they'll trade on exchanges overseas. Well, that's futures trading in the United States. And if the loophole was ended, that would be illegal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then the next answer is, are they going to move overseas? Is Goldman going to pull up stakes in the United States, sell its big building in Jersey City, and the one on Wall Street, and move everybody over to London? That's just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
The final thing is, we've got 20 foreign exchanges right now in the United States with U.S. trading terminals, and their thesis for being here is this is where the liquidity is, this is where the money is. People are not running away from the United States, they're running toward the United States. But nevertheless, there are a series of arguments advanced, and on their face, some of them seem very appealing, and from my perspective, they only confuse the issue. You know, and then it goes back to the point that they've convinced a lot of people it's supply demand and not speculation. And you've got yesterday and today's New York Times with two very bright, able op-ed writers or columnists who are buying their argument hook, line, and sinker. Within those articles, there are issues, assumptions being made that just defy the way these markets operate.
But why would smart people think this way? It's so obvious, if nothing else, even if there was theoretically, you know, not this extraordinary level of speculative manipulation, that there is a reality of equilibrium for supply, demand, and what pricing should be. And this does not even, the current price doesn't even account for the additional reserves in places that have been untapped, like Africa. Like, and again, you know, weighing the environmental issues in Africa, in the shale reserves of the Gulf of Mexico and ANWR. I mean, I just am not understanding how smart people aren't getting the point that even if it is a supply-demand issue, the parabolic movement of the price of oil futures and is just unbelievable. It's almost like they're saying that, you know, it's going to end tomorrow. And even if it does end tomorrow, by the way, then, you know, then the pricing goes away entirely. That's a different story. But it doesn't make sense that there is this supply-demand argument that is pushing prices at this level.
Well, nevertheless, the reality is there are a lot of smart people out there, And the challenge is for people who believe that this is a problem and it's a problem that can be fixed to join in the debate. Unfortunately, we don't have the resources of many of the people we're debating against, but I don't see this as a lost cause. We have to put our wheel to the shoulder here to drive our point home, but there is a major forum where this is being discussed, and that's the United States Congress, and our burden is to bat back all these excuses, and the fundamental excuse is that this is supply-demand. And my fundamental response to that is, well, you say that, but there are markets out there where you cannot observe what's happening. Why don't we just make those markets transparent? And maybe you're right, but I want to see that you're right by looking at those markets and seeing how they function. Mm. What's really being sold to us is, take our word for it, it's supply-demand, but don't look.
All right. So, John, let me ask you this, and we'll kind of bring it to a close here. But, John, we you and I have talked about the whole idea that, you know, when it comes to this issue of, well, a couple of things, but when it comes to the issue of supply-demand, you know, there is that point where people are just going to have to slow down on the consumption of the product, right?
Yeah, but in this case, it's a different situation. It's the way I understand Professor Greenberger here is the following. I'm trading oil. And you're coming in with a bid for some oil, and I say, okay, I want to get, you know, I want to buy a futures contract, and I just tell you that it's $120 or it's $135 or it's $140, and I say that's what it's trading at right now. It's $140, and so you buy it at $140, but it turns out that maybe there's nobody else in this contract. I'm just telling you $140, and if you're stupid enough to believe it, there's no evidence that it really is $140. I think is what he's saying, and it's like, you know, but it's like, and then saying, well, supply and demand. So many people want this, that's why it's $140, when in fact nobody wants it, and you're just holding up the price. I mean, in other words, it's fixed, it's rigged. There's no real market right. If it's completely hidden. It's just what somebody says. You take their word for it, and you go play along with the game. And meanwhile, they, you know, sell it to somebody else for $141, but there may be no action at all for all practical purposes.
So you and I were also talking about one other thing, and I kind of wonder. I don't think we ever got resolution on this, but the whole idea that the delivery, the physical delivery of the oil, is being held up by a few companies to create very similar to what happened with Enron, right? I mean, is that actually happening?
Well, the CFTC took a 180-degree turn on May 29th, and after for 2 years telling people there was no problem here and they had all the data and they were looking at it, announced that they had opened an investigation. And one of the commissioners said that one of the things they were looking at is people playing games with the physical. You know, almost trying to hide the physical on tankers and other things like that. So, yes, that could happen, but the only way we're going to know about it is to open these markets up and have a full and honest investigation. I think the House of Representatives on Thursday passing 401-19 that these markets be investigated by the CFTC is heading in that direction. They tried to pass it by unanimous consent on the Senate. The Republicans objected. They're going to bring it to the floor in 2 weeks. They want to add a rider that there should be drilling on the Outer Continental Shelf. But nevertheless, there's a lot going on. What is needed here is a full, honest, open investigation. My own view is, if there were such an investigation, and if it were joined by the Department of Justice convening a grand jury, you begin to see the price go down because the traders are doing things that they know they can't do with the public watching them or with records being subpoenaed. And I've seen that happen time again, which is to say, one, there's a battle in Congress about changing the laws and getting investigations started. But number two, you can pass all the legislation you want. If you don't have an executive branch that is prepared to do the right thing and at least go look and make an honest evaluation, we'll never get to the bottom of this. One hopes after the elections in November, we'll have such an executive branch.
John, in closing, what do you? I mean, it's mind-boggling to say the least. But you know, what do you think? Ask
project. Well, you know, the one thing I'm glad that at least, I mean, if it wasn't for Professor Greenberger, I don't know, except for George Soros, but nobody takes him seriously as a you know, because they think he has nothing but invested interest in whatever he says. But with the exception of Professor Greenberger, we don't even get this much information. And I'm very disappointed in the media coverage of this, even though the professor sees a lot of activity and discussion in Washington. The public is still completely left out of this loop. They don't know what the heck's going on. They can't complain to Congress if they don't know they should be complaining. I mean, you can tell them to complain, but you've almost been marginalized, Professor, by the media itself. And as you point out, and then you have people backing up the speculators in the New York Times and elsewhere, and as if this is that whatever you've said or whatever Congress is doing and whatever's being discussed in Washington is irrelevant to them. I'm just completely disappointed here with the way things are working.
Well, the one thing I would say is I understand the source of your discouragement, but I think things are a little better than you would portray them. I think it's important to have the kind of discussion we've had today. But for those who are listening to this discussion, I would say don't be discouraged. Be aggressive. The possibility is here to get this fixed. But if we quietly sit in our homes and offices without taking action, it won't get fixed. I can assure you that the Morgan Stanleys, Goldman Sachs of this world have the city filled with people who are advancing the argument that nothing should be done. And the only way to combat that is for each of us to try and do something to, even if we don't agree, to just say, let's have a study, a thorough study done, and a thorough answer given to us. The opponents to what we're trying to accomplish don't want that thorough study, which in and of itself says a lot.
So where can people find you, keep track of you? What are you doing next? I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of, obviously, there is a lot of interest. And I'll just tell you something, that I've written a good amount of pieces for, you know, MSN and my own blog. There is 500, it went up yesterday, 500 comments.
Yeah.
With 80,000 current hits on this. Obviously, people, this is a very passionate and a very concerning issue for many people. So if people want to kind of track this whole thing and watch what's going on, and find how can they do that?
Well, I have been so overwhelmed with requests for testimony I've given. I've now testified 6 times on this. I was just asked yesterday to testify, not so much in the energy crisis, but the subprime meltdown. I'm posting all my materials on a website, which is michaelgreenberger.com. That should be up and running next week.
You better have a good server.
Pardon?
You better have a good server that can handle the requests.
Well, we'll see. But anyway, I am on the faculty of the University of Maryland School of Law, and if you get to that website, you can send me an email about this.
We'll have all those links in the show notes. And I want to tell you, I know how busy you are, and we tracked you down, and I got to tell you, seriously, I really appreciate you spending the time today and taking the time out of your busy schedule to help us with this and spread the news and the information and create a bit more education in this area. So really, with sincere thanks and for the job that you're doing to try to get this thing straight, I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right, we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye. So John.
What?
What do you think about what's – I mean – doesn't it just make you want to scratch your head and go like, what?
But it's like you and Crocs. You know, it's like, it's pretty obvious when you take a look at it, but it's not helped by people like these, you know, columnists and these other guys who are in this, you know, I still think a lot of it has to do with this, you know, well, we have a decision to make here. If we talk more about, you know, Al Gore and Green, that'll solve the problem anyway.
It is really, come on, it's unbelievable that some, again, whether there is, you know, a good amount of supply-demand issue here, which there is, okay, we know that, it is just unbelievable to me that they, you know, people, smart people are writing and discussing that there's no manipulation going, or I should say, no excessive speculation.
Well, no, that's actually say manipulation. You know, the funny thing is that nobody wants to use that word as though it doesn't exist.
I don't understand.
I think the point, you know, the point that he makes, which is the following, you know, is that it's a closed market. It's behind closed doors what's going on. Nobody knows what supply and demand really is back there because it's a big secret. If you can, if you put yourself, create a secret situation, you can create a situation where you can manipulate things. And people want to blame, you know, they don't want to use, it's like the M word. They don't want to use that word. They don't want to scare people into thinking that they can be, they're being had by what's almost a criminal network. You know, I don't even, it's actually not a criminal activity because there's no crime being committed because there's no law against it.
Exactly.
But the fact that it's going on, which is the problem. Anyway, but the fact that it's going on, I think it is just out-and-out manipulation. I don't even think there's a I don't even think it has anything to do with speculation.
I guess what I am most disturbed about is, again, if you just bring it down, don't get into the whole detail and the minutiae of it, but just the Enron loophole itself, just that in itself is very troubling, that this is even allowed to go on unregulated. And there's even discussion that if you look at the people that are regulating it, because it is regulated but not here, it's Dubai. Dubai's basically has the regulation, which, I don't know, do you want Dubai regulating your oil?
Right.
Seems like a slight conflict.
Talk about your conflict of interest.
But in the end, it does seem, and again, I've told you and we talked about much of the opportunity here, and it's very scary because this gets to the heart of every, you know, as a matter of fact, you and I talked about this way back, it must be 8 months ago, I talked about a great idea to fix the economy. And remember I said, we should have, instead of, you know, giving any kind of tax breaks, whatever, simply put a break on the per gallon of gas because that hits the pocketbooks of people immediately. This is way back. We talked about this. Obviously, the other thing that we didn't talk about here today was the extremely interesting lack of discussion of the subject entirely by the president. Isn't that it's more than curiously absent.
Well, the Greenberger indicated or hinted that the president was kind of in on it.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the whole point, isn't it, Mr. Oil Boy? And that's, I tell you something, if they don't fix this, what's going to end up happening is more than a, you know, backfiring on anything about his, you know, his tenure, which is not a, really a wonderful thing that's going to be in the history books for the, anything positive. But I don't know. Anyway, so we'll see about the London loophole. We'll watch that. Last thoughts on this topic?
Yeah, the thing is, you know, it sounds to me as though, even though you've followed this closer than I have in terms of the legislation currently being looked at, it seems to me that it's not completely closed up yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why there's this action going on in Washington right now. There's a lot of discussions, which means that for the short term, the price of oil should, unless these guys try to get out somehow, it should continue to go up.
Yeah, isn't that nice? And especially during the summer.
Well, I mean, this is the time that, you know, that if you looked at the thing from let's say a manipulator's perspective, or you're on say you're long oil, mm-hmm. you know that the demand, summer demand, no matter what people try, how much they try to cut back, there's more air travel and all the rest of it. The stuff's going to keep flowing, and it's going to keep flowing, and people, it's going to hurt the pocketbooks, and it's going to hurt other businesses where people could be spending their money instead. But it's going to at least keep flowing, so they're not going to get – because the problem with oil, of course, is it can get backed up because, you know, you can't stop pumping it once you get – you know, you're pumping away and it goes into the system, and then it has to be refined and then distributed. At some point, if the demand goes down so drastically and it starts to back up, then the jig is up, and the next thing you know, you end up with a collapse of the market, which is what's going to happen eventually. But we don't know what price it's going to happen because there are good plays out there if it does happen. But since we aren't on the side of the manipulators enough to know, so you can't, it almost seems like it's too risky to get in thinking it's going to go to 200 because you don't know when they're going to pull the rug out from under you and just lose everything instantly because right. It will fall fast, right?
Right, exactly.
And so I, you know, have to go. The only thing I can suggest is that there's got to be some moment where you can say this is the moment that it's over. And at that moment, you should be able to be short. You should be able to be short in the various oil categories and do pretty well, it seems to me. But that it's over moment is, I haven't heard it. And now with these articles like those in the New York Times, and I'm hearing more and more about $200, not less. I don't think that moment's yet.
Well, and I'm trying to also figure, you know, if you know, the average gasoline use per household, whatever that number is, and you take, let's say, 25 gallons per week on average, and you just add the cost factors that have been, you know, moved up for the last year, $2, let's say, per gallon. So about $50 a week. I mean, again, I'm not giving the exact numbers here, but just as an idea, you know, you have that much per week. You multiply it out. I mean, where are people in this kind of environment going to get that kind of money to live? It's just, it's preposterous.
Well, I think a lot of people are having trouble. But, you know, in the 70s, I remember this process being, it was different because that was, again, it was manipulation again.
Well, that was the embargo. That was just, they did that in a wonderful mechanism to show their strength and basically just cut us off. They turned the spigot off. They're turning the spigot on here,
right,
and saying that it's every piece of news is taken and twisted. The Saudis said that they will pump as much as they need to, et cetera. There was discussion by other nations saying, well, if they're going to pump that much, we're going to probably have a problem because we're not going to be needed as much. In other words, not everybody would have to continue to pump as much if that was the case. Crazy.
Yeah, no, this situation is much more sophisticated than it was in the 70s, which was pretty straightforward. But you did see similar commentary by the media. And a lot of it had to do with, well, you know, we shouldn't be driving these big cars. And so the big car sales fell through the floor. And meanwhile, you could actually, by the end of that cycle, you could have bought those big cars that were, some of them very expensive. You could have bought them for pennies on the dollar. And I think we're going to see that opportunity again. Not that people should be buying Hummers, but there's a lot of cars that, you know, people might not be buying today because they're, I feel sorry for people. I go to the gas, I drive, you know, cars that get fairly good at mileage. But I go to the gas pumps and I see these people drive up in these Tahoes and these Suburbans and drop $250
and
bucks
in the tank.
And
not to mention boating, and the pricing of boating is outrageous. This is what I'm going to do. We're going to end it here. We can go on for hours and days like you and I do oftentimes. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to put on the website my investment plays for this current market and for the current oil. I'm going to lay out an investment idea, which will encompass some of the shorting of oil, of course, or shorting some of that. I'll show you exactly how to do that. So John C. Dvorak, where do we find you, of course?
Dvorak.org/blog for just my general stuff. But I'm in MarketWatch, and you can find my column there, and also PC Magazine and some other places around the world. Bug Magazine in Croatia, if you're listening from
love that. I have a lifetime subscription to that.
I'm also in Brazil, which is at the Info Magazine. But the funny thing about, you know, we didn't bring up is that Brazil, who does a country that does a wonderful job of, you know, growing gasoline with their sugarcane crops, and now has a huge discovery of oil there. Brazil's interesting because it's an economy that would be an interesting investment opportunity in some way, shape, or form with all this energy they're getting.
It's been very wild, I will tell you. I do not want to belabor this. I just want to have three sentences on this. But I read an interesting article about Twitter. Basically, Twitter is seemingly being thrown out. Did you see the replies are down? And again, I'm not a big Twitter fan. I know or Twitter user. You have, I don't know, 25, 30,000 people that follow you. But what's interesting is that I read some article that they are just having huge problems. And my understanding is they're really only running that whole thing off of like two servers.
Well, you know, they got a bunch of money and they should be able to upgrade the system. The reason that the numbers are down, and I can attest to this because I haven't posted at all, is that they've turned off one of the mechanisms that's critical to the success of the product, which is the replies mechanism.
Yeah. Whoops.
And until they get that up again, their numbers are going to stay low.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, we'll talk soon, and thanks for joining us. And this is a discussion you and I are going to have for some time to come, hopefully not, but for some time to come. And thanks for bringing me all the things you did on this and making us aware for people out there. We'll follow this as best we can. And everybody out there, go to Dvorak.org/blog. There are some great things on there, great videos, great commentary. I think you'll really enjoy it. John C. Dvorak, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Andrew. I hope to be back on again soon.
And that you will. But now, it's time for the Zach Zone with Zachary Scheidt. Zach is a portfolio manager at Stearman Capital and blogs at ZachStocks.com.
Well, hey, Andrew. What an ugly week we had in the market last week. I tell you what, this is getting kind of scary. I think we're going to see some historical times if we haven't already. It's been quite a year. But as far as new issues are concerned, the last week we didn't see any new IPOs priced. Basically, the market continues to languish, and the liquidity is hard to find, and everybody knows that. And so nobody's dumb enough to try to bring an IPO in this type of market. However, we did have kind of a surprising number of secondary offerings, and I think the rationale behind it is that people who have been sitting on the sidelines and they need to sell stock, whether it be the companies themselves needing to raise capital or whether it be private investors that need to get out or get some of their capital back, they're starting to see this window close and they're starting to see the market head down and they're getting scared. And so they're saying, hey, you know what? I need to go ahead and bail out at any price. And so we saw 9 different secondaries price. And there's just a lot of fear in the market. And so because of that fact, I think it was 6 of the 9 actually traded down from their offering price. However, there was a little bit of a bright spot, and this is kind of comical, actually. But the one deal that did the very best was Central European Distribution Company, CEDC. And these guys are actually one of the chief makers of vodka, and they distribute 700 different alcoholic brands throughout Poland. All right, so we're going to hold off on the Polish jokes for right now. But honestly, when you look at what sectors have done well during bear markets, it's pretty well known that the alcoholic industry is a defensive kind of a play, and so that might not be a bad area to look, whether you're looking with the domestic producers and distributors or looking abroad at a company like CEDC. So I think that you could potentially buy this stock on a pullback, but for right now it's a little bit extended. It's actually up 10% from the offering price, which was $68 earlier this week. Looking forward to next week, there actually are 2 IPOs on the calendar. Now, whether they get done or not will be, well, that just kind of remains to be seen. But there's one pretty good-looking IPO. It's in the company's called Energy Recovery, Inc., ticker symbol ERII. And these guys actually help with the water desalination process. It's a very intensive process. Energy-intensive process, and what these guys do is they help the water treatment plants actually recover some of that energy. So it's a neat kind of play on both the energy sector as well as the water or the commodity. You know, water is actually becoming a commodity these days, but on that industry as well. So ERII is actually likely to do fairly well, and if you can get shares on the deal, I'd actually encourage you to try to take advantage of this one. They're probably going to price it at an attractive level between $7 and $9. And if you can get shares, it's probably worth taking. And it's definitely worth looking at in the aftermarket, maybe buying on a pullback over the next week or two. A second IPO that's coming out is called Galliott Capital Corp, ticker symbol GTC. And this is actually a newly formed specialty finance company that's going to be investing in mortgage-backed securities. Now, if this sounds familiar, it's because there have been a few other IPOs that have come out this way. And like I said on the last few, I think that this may not be a bad business idea, but as an IPO investor, you definitely don't want to be buying this one on the deal. It's a much better deal to get it in the aftermarket, so you want to wait a week or two and let this thing kind of trail off a little bit, let the initial hype get over with, and you can buy it at a much cheaper price a week or two down the road, if you even want to be involved in this. They're going to be buying some of this toxic waste and probably going to get it at a decent price, but there's still a lot of questions out there in the finance area. So that's what I've got for you on the week ahead, and I would appreciate it if you give me a visit at zachstocks.com, ZACHstocks.com. We'll be looking at a lot of these names during the week as they begin trading, and hope that you have a great week, and we'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Hey, thanks, Zach. It's always a real pleasure. We had a great show last week. Great time seeing you down here. And that about wraps it up for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. As I promised, I put a lot of information on the website for you. Check it out. There's ways you write your congressman, write your senator. There's some videos from Greenberger. Check it out at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Until next time, be well. We'll talk to you soon. This is Andrew Horowitz on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.